This is the last lecture of the course. So I thought I would end the course by sort of just giving a brief overview of some of the interesting topics in gravitational wave astronomy and strong gravity in general. So this is going to be sort of a very cursory treatment of a lot of different topics. But if you're interested in something, feel free to just stop me and ask more questions. We definitely don't have to get through all the material today. So I thought I'd begin, with, of course, the recent breakthroughs in gravitational wave astronomy. One of the, most exciting things in the field is gravitational wave observations of compact object mergers. So let's begin with that. So, these are made possible by ground-based gravitational wave observatories like LIGO, and there's one in Italy called Virgo, and there's one in Japan now called KAGRA, which is beginning to increase in sensitivity. And these all basically work in the following way. They have some laser interferometer where you have laser light that's split into two arms and bounces light back and forth and then comes back and interferes with itself here. And you can basically use the readout of how the laser interferes with itself, whether you get a dark spot or a light spot, or equivalently, you can sort of control the how this is read out and then read out how much you have to sort of move the mirrors by to get that to interfere in the proper way to basically very precisely measure the relative arm length of these this interferometer. So these arms are about 4 kilometers long each. And that means if you have, for example, a gravitational wave that's coming into the board here, it'll stretch one length and squeeze the other one. And then as it oscillates, it'll stretch the side and expand that one. It'll be an oscillating pattern. And from this differential change in the arm lengths, you can read out the gravitational wave signal. So I'm not going to go into all the details of that. Sort of the most important point that I want you to take away is kind of what frequency ranges these ground-based gravitational wave observatories are sensitive to. So the sort of sensitivity curve looks something like this. Where, so this is sort of strain per root hertz. And these numbers are kind of astonishingly small, something like 10 to the minus 23. So basically, this bucket where the noise curve is sort of the lowest is the part where the instrument's the most sensitive. And it's sort of from 10 hertz to a few hundred hertz. And then it starts to go up around a kilohertz. And here, this main noise curve, the noise going up is mainly due to seismic noise. That's, the Earth is vibrating at these lower frequencies, and that gives you some source of noise because it's shaking your mirrors and so forth. And then at the high frequency, and this is due to quantum or shot noise. But basically, because you're sort of sensitive to these, around, 100 hertz to kilohertz frequency ranges, that means that this instrument is good for looking at the mergers of stellar mass compact objects. So let's talk about the different kinds of compact object mergers. So there's basically three different kinds that we've seen with gravitational waves so far. One is a binary black hole merger. That's two black holes merging with each other. The other is a binary neutron star, two neutron stars merging with each other. And then the third one is a mix of the two, a black hole merging with a neutron star. So we'll start with binary black hole mergers, which were the first ones seen back in 2015. So binary black hole mergers are kind of nice conceptually because we think they're completely described by vacuum solutions to the Einstein equations. At least as far as we know. So we just need to look for solutions of this one equation. Though, of course, as we sort of saw throughout this class, actually coming up with solutions to these equations, especially in the nonlinear regime, can be very difficult, and you have to combine a lot of different techniques. So the gravitational wave signal, you look at sort of the strain as a function of time. You can basically break it up into three stages. The first stage is when the black holes are relatively far apart and they're orbiting around each other. That's called the in-spiral regime. And so there, we expect the gravitational wave signal to basically have twice the frequency of the orbital frequency. And it sort of slowly increases in amplitude and frequency as the black holes get closer to each other, as they lose energy and angular momentum to gravitational waves. So that's called the in spiral. Then at some point they'll get close enough that the radiation reaction from gravitational waves become significant. They're moving close to the speed of light, and you'll have this very dynamical stage where the black holes are starting to get closer and closer to each other, and then finally form one black hole. So that's the merger. And of course, it's a little bit fuzzy where exactly we draw the line between these two. And then the final stage, which we talked about last class, is when you create this final remnant black hole, it's initially perturbed and it wants to settle down to a Kerr solution. And that's the ring down phase. So we can basically use different approaches to tackle these different regimes. So for the in spiral, a common technique is to use what's called post-Newtonian approximation. And I'll say more about what that is in a little bit. And then for the merger, once things become so this post-Newtonian approximation basically works when things are moving not too close to the speed of light, but it breaks down in the final stages. It definitely breaks down, by the time you get to the final stages of the merger. So in that case, you want to use numerical relativity, that is numerical solutions of these equations. And then at some point, as the black hole settles down, it should eventually be described by linear perturbation theory around a Kerr solution. So then we can use black hole perturbation theory, like we talked about last class. So to say a little bit about post-Newtonian. So the idea is there is basically to expand the Einstein equations, but use basically m over r, which is a dimensionless number, and geometric units, right? The g and the c squared there, and v over c as our small parameters. So the velocity is small compared to the speed of light. And basically from the Virial theorem, expect for, some sort of bound system like a quasi-circular orbit, these basically be comparable, right? Yeah, so and so if we call this this small parameter, which is v over c squared or m over r epsilon, then basically you'll often hear in the literature like, oh, this is a 2pn result or something. So that means that it's up to that means it's up to epsilon to that number. So sometimes you'll see sort of 1.5 pn, which would be the same as v to the third power, right? So for example, so we're not going to go through any derivations of post-Newtonian results. In some sense, the ones you did in the tutorial are kind of the first step, which would be to take a Newtonian orbit and then sort of calculate the gravitational radiation from that. But for example, for two-body motion, we could write our acceleration law like this. So the Newtonian result is just given by the gravitational potential. Here's the total mass. And then we basically, would start to write down some perturbation series. And just to give you an example, I'll write down this first post-Newtonian correction. And here, by mu tilde, I just mean the reduced mass divided by the total mass, which is given by that. But yeah, you can see that we have various terms that are either proportional to m over r, so we expect that to be small wide separations, or proportional to some power of velocity. And so, yeah, so again, if this moving at velocities that are small compared to the speed of light. So I think this term is actually the one responsible for this periastron events of an eccentric orbit, which is one of the kind of early tests of GR. But actually getting the radiation the effect of gravitational radiation due to gravitational waves that occurs at 2.5 pn. I think in one of the tutorials, you kind of worked this out, but just to kind of recap, let's consider if we have some quasi-circular orbit, so at leading orders have a Newtonian orbit, and then we want to calculate basically how the frequency of that circular orbit will change if we just calculate the loss of energy due to gravitational waves in the using the quadrupole formula. Angular frequency omega squared is given by m over r, and the orbital energy is minus mu, that's reduced mass, times m over 2r. And then if we want to write that in terms of frequency, we can just use this. We're going to now take a derivative of this with respect to time, imagining that the frequency is going to change if we're going to basically start inspiraling faster due to gravitational waves. So just take a time derivative, and we get a 3 here, and like a dot, and then minus a third. Yeah, and then if we now we want to compute the loss of basically the power carried away in gravitational waves. So previously in class, we derived that that's given by calculating this reduced quadrupole tensor, taking 3 time derivatives and then contracting it with itself. So not going to go through that whole calculation, but roughly we know that this is going to go like the reduced mass, the separation squared, and then since the binary is orbiting with frequency omega, then this quadrupole tensor, which essentially goes like the square, will go at twice the frequency. And that means that if we take 3 time derivatives, then we're going to get this extra factor of omega squared. So then we can just plug that in here. Yeah, now we just want to say that the that the loss in orbital energy is equal to this gain in gravitational energy. And in particular, we're interested in how the frequency evolves with time as a function of frequency. So, from that we get omega dot 1/3, and then here we have a omega to the, is that right? Oh yes, sorry, here I'm gonna plug in, I'm gonna use this one to also get rid of this R, because that'll also be changing as we inspiral. Yeah, so putting it all together, basically the way the frequency is going to change as a function of time is going to be proportional to this frequency to the 11th third power. And if we had sort of done that calculation keeping track of all the numerical factors, we would have gotten the following. And this is, now I'm going to write in terms of the gravitational wave frequency, which is twice the orbital frequency. This is this, but just restoring the numerical factors, and you can see that basically there's going to be this one sort of one number with sort of physical dimensions, this curly M I've written here, and so that's actually called the chirp mass. And the reason that that's why that's important, why it has its own name, is it's basically, in a sense, the most well-measured parameter of a gravitational wave signal. So if you think of sort of plotting a gravitational wave signal on what's called a spectrogram, so that's where you have time on one axis and frequency on the other axis. So you divide your signal into small chunks of time and then basically do a Fourier transform within each of those chunks. And then the spectrogram will basically show you how much power there'll be in each frequency as a function of time. Then you sort of get something like this for the end spiral. You know, you get this chirp up in frequency as it increases, and basically, what determines this curve here is the chirp mass. So this, yeah, and I should write down what exactly that is. So that's basically this reduced mass to the 3/5 power times the total mass. So for many gravitational wave signals, we'll have sort of very good information about what this chirp mass is, but we may be less sure what the individual masses of the constituents are. So yeah, and you know, and also sort of the total mass will kind of set the, yeah. Yeah, one other thing we can use this to calculate here is basically the number of cycles that will, of gravitational wave cycles that will occur for a signal in between any two frequencies. So to do that, we just basically integrate f over f dot as a function of frequency between two different frequencies. And if we just use that relationship there, get this, or that it's basically proportional to our starting frequency to the minus 5/3 minus the end frequency. So if we consider a situation where this higher frequency is much higher than our low frequency, we can see that basically the number of cycles you see in between these two different frequencies is basically going to be proportional to the lower frequency to the minus 5/3. So at low frequencies, you see many cycles. At high frequencies, you don't see as many cycles, basically because the binary is n spiraling, so is faster. Now, so for example, if you can kind of imagine changing the lower frequency part of your noise curve so that you could see, you know, you could see frequencies of down to 10 hertz compared to, say, 40 hertz. You know, that basically increases the number of cycles by a factor of 10. So calculating these post-Newtonian expansion is, you know, still an ongoing project. With these calculations, you know, sort of getting increasingly more complicated as you go to a higher order, and so currently, folks have kind of worked out to 4pn. Though I should mention, this is in general only an asymptotic series, which means that, you know, it's not clear that as you go to higher and higher order, you can still, you know, maybe that you have to kind of consider earlier and earlier in the n-spiral for those to be accurate. But so far, for the sort of comparable mass compact object mergers, it seems like, you know, just adding more PN terms is still continuing to help. And you can still push that relatively close to the merger. Any questions so far? Okay, so that was the n spiral. So now let's talk a little bit about the merger and numerical relativity techniques. So, you know, at the merger, you sort of need to solve the full equations. And because they're sort of complicated partial differential equations, that's done numerically. Yeah, and you know, of course, you know, if you're just solving these full equations numerically, you know, of course that's accurate in any part of this regime. But you know, the reason why typically in the early n spiral, you know, something like post-Newtonian is more is important to have is basically because These numerical simulations of, for example, compact object binaries can be rather expensive, basically because you have to resolve a range of scales. You basically have your smallest scale is going to be the size of your black holes or your other compact objects. Then you have a larger scale that would be sort of the orbital separation of the objects. And then you have an even larger scale, which would be kind of the distance in which you can unambiguously extract the gravitational waves, sort of the wave zone, where you can sort of extract the signal that you're interested in computing. And so for that reason, sort of becomes infeasible to calculate, very long end spirals that have many, many orbits. So at some point you want to, switch to using something like post-Newtonian. But this works very well around merger. But so there are a number of ingredients that you sort of need to combine to try to numerically solve the Einstein equations, for example, for binary black holes. So one thing that we discussed in class is that you need a well-posed formulation of the evolution equations. So in class, we discussed the generalized harmonic formulation. In tutorial, you worked out another one called BSSN. There's other ones, for example, one called conformal Z4, which is sort of somewhat in between these two. But that was sort of a major stumbling block, was to find a well-posed formulation for the evolution equations, and also kind of one that was both well-posed and also allowed you to sort of pick appropriate gauges for computing things like what happens when black holes merge. We also mentioned briefly in class that not only do you want a well-posed formulation, but you also want to be able to control any constraint violating modes. So because the Einstein equations basically have this redundancy, you can choose some equations to evolve with, but there'll be these additional constraints that should be satisfied at any time. They will be if you're exactly solving Einstein equations, but if you have some numerical errors, then you can worry about having these constraint violating modes grow uncontrollably. So we mentioned constraint damping is one technique within this generalized harmonic formulation for dealing with things like that. Another thing you need is good initial data. So in class, we talked about some different formulations for solving the Hamiltonian momentum constraint. And we also briefly discussed some of the challenges associated with the fact that it's not sufficient just to find a solution that solves the constraint equations, but you also want it to give a good representation of the physical system that you're interested in. Because these numerical simulations can't start with the binary black holes kind of at arbitrarily large separations, they need to have some initial data that describes them sort of relatively close by, and then typically you get effects like you can have some residual orbital eccentricity in your initial data, which you want to get under control, or you can have what's called junk radiation, sort of spurious gravitation waves that occur just because your initial data wasn't a completely accurate description of the physical system. Yeah, and then As I mentioned here, you need to find some way to resolve all these disparate length scales. So, you know, one very common technique is what's called adaptive mesh refinement. So you sort of put more grid points around your black holes, then fewer grid points away from your black holes, and then, you know, fewer ones going out to the wave zone. Another technique is to sort of use what are called spectral methods, where you use special functions and again sort of adapt them sort of where you place boundaries and how you choose those to put more resolution around your compact objects and less far away from them. And then finally, you have to find some way to handle the singularity that you get inside the black hole. So, you know, if you're evolving a binary black hole, you know, within the black hole horizons, the curvature is going to be blowing up, and the equations are going to be breaking down, and that's going to make your code crash unless you figure out some way to handle that. So one technique is called excision. So the idea there is just to basically remove part of the domain inside the black hole from, and just exclude that from your calculation. And you know, normally, you know, if you're evolving some equations, you can't just remove part of the domain and still expect to get the right answer. You know, because information could propagate sort of out of that region. And if you don't know what's happening in that region, you can't get the solution everywhere. But you can take advantage of the particular fact about black hole horizons that, you know, basically at the horizon, or if you consider it a trapped surface inside the horizon, then information is only propagating in. It's not propagating out. So it's actually valid to basically remove that from your domain. And only calculate the solution that propagates in. Besides, that's not the only technique. Another popular one is basically to use particular coordinates in which your black holes become what are called punctures. And basically, the physical singularity is sort of shrunk to be kind of infinitely far away from the rest of your domain. So that's another technique that people use. Yeah. So, you know, the sort of first simulations of binary black holes are done a little less than 20 years ago in 2005. And then since then, you know, people have started to map out the parameter space and get very accurate simulations. Though, of course, this isn't a completely solved problem in terms of, you know, considering different mass ratios, different spins, different alignments for the spins with respect to the orbit, which can give you precession, or going beyond considering these quasi-circular orbits to considering eccentric orbits. So maybe to mention one interesting result that came out of studying binary black holes, in particular the merger, is to show that when the black holes merge, you actually, if you look at the final black hole, you actually find that it gets a kick or a recoil. And that can be basically understood as you know, as these binary black holes are merging, there's kind of a, you know, preferred direction with respect to their orbit, in which they're emitting gravitational radiation, and in particular, which they're emitting linear momentum in the gravitational wave. And so, when they're at far distances, that kind of averages out over a cycle. It doesn't give you a kick, but in the final stages where the black holes are, the binary is evolving very rapidly, there'll kind of be some preferent, the gravitational waves that are emitted during that phase will carry linear momentum preferentially in some direction. And that means at the end, the black hole will have some kick or a recoil velocity that will compensate for the extra momentum that was carried away in the gravitational waves. And so, for example, for like a non-spinning black hole, if you plot that as a function of the reduced mass, actually, so this effect goes away for equal mass, but has some maximum for slightly smaller reduced masses around 0.2. And here the kick velocity is about, the maximum one is about 250 kilometers per second. It is possible to sort of arrange for even more extreme scenarios. For example, if you have black holes that have that are spinning and their spins point towards each other, this is sometimes called a super kick configuration, and there the recoil velocities can actually reach like 4,000 kilometers per second. So this might actually be related to what happens when two galaxies merge, and there you expect if they both have supermassive black holes in their center, those will eventually find each other and merge, and they might get some recoil velocity. Right, and then we basically talked about this ring down phase last time in class. Oops. Actually, let me. But just to kind of put that in terms of physical numbers. So I think last time in class, we said that we looked at the least damped mode for.
Remove the things inside the horizons.
Mm-hmm.
How can you simulate? So actually, you simulate the two horizon motion.
So yeah. That's a great question. You're asking if we're excising some region inside the black hole, but then the black holes are moving. Like, how do we keep track of that?
Yeah. So it's about the horizon moment. How they
Yeah. So with these excision techniques, basically you have to keep track of where the horizons are. So basically, this is where this concept of apparent horizons that we discussed in a previous lecture comes in. So if you're using excision, basically every time step or every few time steps, you need to again find where your black hole horizons are. And then you need to use that to adjust your excision surface. So you need to kind of move these excision surfaces along with the black hole. And to do that, you need to keep.
How the two horizon merge to be a one is like a waveform that some turbulence the two horizon combine each other or some other way that they combine?
Yeah, so in terms of apparent horizons, what actually happens is, so you have like the two separate apparent horizons kind of right before merger, and then right after merger there'll be an additional apparent horizon that encompasses both of them. So And so actually, at this point, all three of these will be marginally outer trapped surfaces. But basically, in terms of, but this one will technically be the apparent horizon because it's the outermost one. So basically, probably before you're, excising this region and this region, and then you find this bigger apparent horizon that's like the final black hole, and then you can just excise this whole thing.
So is there any process for the two one to become a bigger one, or directly at some point, directly suddenly to become a one, bigger one?
So for basically apparent horizons don't do that. The event horizon does do that. Like the event horizon is this we drew this like pair of pants diagram before where it does basically, well, here I'm adding time or whatever, where they do basically join together. But for the apparent horizons, they don't have basically I think there's some theorem under some conditions where basically they can't touch unless there's a bigger horizon that encompasses them. Yeah, so typically you're excising based on the apparent horizon as opposed to the event horizon. And the apparent horizon is basically telling you how information is propagating locally, and the event horizon, which is kind of where you want to excise in terms of having your equations be well posed. And the event horizon is telling you where information propagates all the way out to future null infinity.
So here we don't assume that the horizon has some turbulence when they merge or something.
Some turbulence. Yeah, you're saying like, do these get like very distorted or something when they merge?
They can detect from the data if there are some turbulence or.
Yeah, I don't think you really see signs of that. I mean, there is some debate about whether or not this, like, what's the topology of like these event horizons, and do you ever get ones that are kind of more complicated, like, something like that. Instead of like that for the event horizon on some time slice. I think basically it is possible to choose some time coordinates where you get like that for a very short amount of time. But yeah, like in terms of having very high frequency stuff or something, yeah, it doesn't seem that turbulent, which maybe is connected to this fact that, black hole horizons are kind of very viscous in some sense. They like to resist being perturbed, and if you perturb them, they settle down very quickly. But yeah, great question.
Another question, is there any condition that two binary black hole at some point they will merge? So there are external force to let them merge at some point. So what are the condition that they will merge?
I mean, basically, if you have two objects in a bound orbit, like they should like, they're always losing energy to gravitational waves, so eventually they should merge. But it kind of if they're too far apart, that merger time might be, longer than the age of the universe or something like that. But yeah, I mean, if you have a system in a bound orbit, and you're willing to wait long enough, everything should eventually merge. Yeah, so I was I was saying that last time in class you mentioned that the ring down frequency for this L equals two M equals two quasi-neural mode, which is the least damped one, and the one that kind of dominates, for example, a equal mass quasi-circular merger is about 0.5 in units of 1 over m. So if we go to gravitational wave frequency, should just be this divided by 2 pi, and then we restore physical units here. This is like something like a few hundred hertz if we consider a binary with a total mass of around 60 solar masses. You can see that if we go to lower masses, and basically this ring down frequency is going to be the highest frequency component in the gravitational wave signal. And you can see that if we go to higher masses, for example, we consider two neutron stars, which typically have masses around one solar mass merging, then this would be up by a factor of 30 or something. Then you're in the kilohertz regime. Typically it's only these rather massive binary black hole mergers where you kind of see the whole where you see the whole gravitational wave signal in a detector like LIGO. For ones with lower masses, you might see more cycles in band, but you won't necessarily see the merger. Yeah, so speaking of binary neutron star mergers, so the sort of spectacular example of that one was this gravitational wave event that occurred in on August 17th in 2017, and was relatively close by, about 40 megaparsecs. And not only do we see the gravitational wave signal from that event, we saw a whole bunch of electromagnetic transients that were associated with these two neutron stars merging. So let's discuss a little bit about binary neutron star mergers. So in this case, we can't just solve the Einstein equations. We also have to have some description for our matter. So kind of the simplest way one could describe a neutron star is just as a fluid using the kind of general relativistic Euler equations. So the two equations there are, so here, this is the rest mass density, rho naught. This is the forward velocity of the fluid, UA. And this equation basically encapsulates the conservation of the rest mass. So that's one equation. And then the second equation is just the conservation of stress energy. And the stress energy tensor for a perfect fluid is the energy density plus the pressure times forward velocity, UA, UB. And then there's a pressure term times the metric. And basically you have five equations here. So this is one equation, and then we have four equations here because of this free B index. And we basically have six unknowns. So that's the rest. So I can just turn my, so this rho here is the total energy density, and we can write it as the rest mass density plus an additional component, which would be called, is usually called the specific energy epsilon. So the unknown quantities are going to be the rest mass density, specific energy, the pressure, and the velocity. We can always get the fourth component, the four velocity, just by normalization. So basically, we need one additional piece of information, which is a relation between the pressure and the other fluid quantities. So that's usually known as the equation of state. But a big problem is we don't actually know the equation of state of neutron stars. So, a neutron star is an object that has a mass typically of around, say, 1.4 times the mass of the sun, and a radius of, say, 10 or 15 kilometers, something around there. So they're enormously dense. The density is something like 10 to the 15 grams per centimeter cubed. And basically, we don't really know well how matter behaves at these extremely high densities. And in fact, we can kind of see this as a good thing in that hopefully we could use gravitational wave observations of neutron star mergers to tell us what this equation of state is. But in practice, this means when you kind of want to compute the potential gravitational wave signal, you have to consider different equations of state within the realm of possibility, and then see how that can affect the gravitational wave signal. And then hopefully if it affects in some strong way, that's actually good and that you can potentially use an observation to learn something. So the leading order effect of the fact that we have matter instead of black holes in the N-spiral is actually going to be due to the tidal deformations of the neutron star. So but that actually comes at rather high post-Newtonian order. So if we look at the gravitational wave phase as a function of frequency, kind of at leading order, we have this chirp mass that we mentioned earlier. And then we have all these PN corrections. And then at rather high post-Newtonian order, fifth post-Newtonian order, we have a contribution that's due to the tidal deformability of the neutron star. And here X is just again, this normalized frequency to the two-thirds. Right, so this yeah, so this effect on the N-spiral gravitational wave signal actually comes from the fact that due to its companion, a neutron star will be tidally distorted. You know, it'll the part of the star that's closer to the companion will want to be stretched compared to one that's far away, and this will deform the star a little bit, and that'll basically cause a little extra gravitational, basically a little less, take a bit more energy out of the orbit and cause the end spiral to happen faster. So this tidal parameter is a term like this in terms of the two masses, and this tidal deformability parameter is I'm calling lambda here, and then there's another term where we just switch out one and two, or one and two label the two objects in our system. And to leading order, that's that's going to be written like this, and this K2 is sometimes called the love number, dimensionless love number. So basically this lambda here measures so if we have a if we consider our neutron star to be in a in some sort of gravitational field, then we expect it to be deformed into a quadrupole by some amount that's proportional to the tidal field that it feels, and that proportionality constant is this lambda. So here, this is the tidal tensor, and this is the quadrupole deformation. Yeah. So anyway, this is a long way to say that basically, if we can measure you know, accurately the late end spiral of these neutron stars, what occurs at high frequencies, where these additional terms will become important, then potentially we can see the effect of the fact that the neutron star is not a black hole, that it can be tidally deformed by its companion. And that will kind of, to leading order, tell us, you know, say the radius of the neutron star, and give us information about the equation of state. And then, of course, after the neutron stars merge, they can give rise to kind of a whole host of electromagnetic transients, as was seen after the merger, either by throwing off some of this very dense material, which undergoes radioactive decay and emits optical and UV light, or also by producing gamma ray bursts that's we believe sourced by the remnant compact object, probably a black hole or a bigger hypermassive neutron star that's fed by some remaining accretion disk. I think we're out of time here, but happy to stick around and answer any questions. Yep.
So, how can we know whether the two binary neutron stars are electron star to become a magneton or the black hole, then you can know when.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of a big unknown question. I mean, in some sense, if we knew the neutron star equation of state, then we could sort of figure that out, right? So when we learn new things about the neutron star equation of state, that kind of tells us whether it's more likely or less likely for an object that has kind of the total mass of the binary to be able to be long-lived or not. I mean, you can also try to use observations of the electromagnetic transients that follow the merger and try to connect them to, you know, whether or not you think, you know, the kind of, you know, like a short gamma ray burst could only arise from a black hole with an accretion disk, or whether it could be also come from like a magnetar or something like that. But yeah, I think in general, since we're not able to see, you know, the ring down gravitational wave signal because it's at such high frequency, or in the case that the two neutron stars merge and create like a bigger neutron star that'll also oscillate at sort of kilohertz frequencies, and because we can't see the gravitational waves from that, at least not yet, we don't have a sort of smoking gun evidence whether or not it collapse a black hole or not. Okay, well, if there are any other questions, please feel free to come up.